Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Hey clones, what's cracking? Smack Off Week rolls on in the jungle. One more show until Smack Off 23. The countdown is on. We are almost there. In sports, the Cowboys make a decision in the best interest of the team. Well, that's their story, and they're sticking to it. I've got thoughts on the Lucky Whitehead story as it continues to unfold. Plus, the Choppa makes its 27 debut. Find out what golden ticket winner got their ticket ripped back just 48 hours from the Smack Off. And three great guests. USF quarterback Quentin Flowers, former champ and Showtime boxing analyst Pauly Malignaggi, and newly retired former NFL wide receiver Andrew Hawkins. Alvin, obviously a ton to get to, so let's not waste any time. Fire this bad boy up right now. I want to start with the Dallas Cowboys. In fact, it's going to take me a minute or two to lay it out. Lucky Whitehead continues to be the offseason's most bizarre story, and it just keeps getting more and more bizarre. Previously, on the summer of Lucky Whitehead, we learned that Rodney Lucky Whitehead had been charged in a Virginia shoplifting case, and there was a warrant out for his arrest. In the wake of that news, the Cowboys released him, but in a dramatic plot twist, it turns out Lucky was incorrectly charged, and the real shoplifter was somebody who claimed to be Lucky Whitehead, but really wasn't Lucky Whitehead. In other words, freaking drama. Except the Cowboys did not change their decision. Whitehead, understandably irritated, he told the Dallas Morning News, quote, "Let's not sugarcoat anything. I was pretty much being called a liar," end quote. Now, granted, it is pretty crazy that somebody was arrested for shoplifting, pretended to be Lucky Whitehead, and the police in Virginia believed it. And then the Cowboys acted on it. Except Rodney feels like the team never even tried to help him out. Quote, "As far as the whole situation went down, I was blindsided. I didn't know about a warrant that came about in the first place. Clearly, because I wasn't the person arrested. The head person in the Cowboys organization, I told, no one backed me up. No one had my back in that whole situation. I knew about it at what, 12:45? By 2:30, I'm released." End quote. So it's going to be interesting to see how the Cowboys handle this, right? Then you get Jason Garrett's presser. Finally, we're going to get some answers about what was going on with this entire situation. Or maybe not at all. Let's just say that Jason Garrett's interest in answering questions about Lucky Whitehead were lower than a crippled cricket's ass. He lasted maybe 3 minutes at that press conference, but what a presser it was. Here are the highlights.
"Decision that we deem to be in the best interest of the Dallas Cowboys. We're standing by that decision. We're going to move on."
"But that decision was based on the idea that he had been arrested last week, correct?"
Yesterday we made a decision that we thought was in the best interest of the Dallas Cowboys. And we're going to stand by that decision. We're going to move on."
"Not fair to him to just keep saying that over and over?"
"It's the truth. We made a decision that we thought was in the best interest of the Dallas Cowboys."
"The rest wasn't the truth."
"I'm not asking about any individual investigator or any particular incident. But do you have some people working for the Dallas Cowboys that are just too stupid to work for this team?"
"I'll stand by the statement that I made. We made a decision yesterday that we thought was in the best interest of the Dallas Cowboys, and we're going to stand by that decision. We're going to move forward."
Listen, that repeated answer would have been good if the questions were, when did you make the decision?
Yesterday we made a decision that we thought was in the best interest of the Dallas Cowboys, and we're going to stand by that decision. We're going to move on."
Or, "Coach, did you deem that decision to be in the best interest of the Dallas Cowboys?"
"Yesterday we made a decision that we thought was in the best interest of the Dallas Cowboys, and we're going to stand by that decision. We're going to move on."
Hey, Coach, quick question. Are you standing by that decision?
"Yesterday we made a decision that we thought was in the best interest of the Dallas Cowboys, and we're going to stand by that decision. We're going to move on."
"Coach, allow me to follow up. Are you planning to move on?"
"Yesterday we made a decision that we thought was in the best interest of the Dallas Cowboys, and we're going to stand by that decision. We're going to move on."
Except those weren't the questions, right? Those were not the questions. But he just kept repeating the same statement over and over and over again. And did you happen to catch that one reporter ask, and I quote, "Do you have some people working for the Dallas Cowboys that are just too stupid to work for this team?"
I'm not asking about any individual investigator or any particular incident. But do you have some people working for the Dallas Cowboys that are just too stupid to work for this team?
Straight freaking fire! Now that's bringing the heat. Bobby Ramos bottom line style. But even that wouldn't rattle or hook Garrett. He had his answer, and he was sticking to it no matter what.
Yesterday we made a decision that we thought was in the best interest of the Dallas Cowboys. And we're going to stand by that decision, and we're going to move on.
All right, now forget the comparisons to Marshawn and Belichick. Garrett skipped over them and went straight to Rasheed Wallace's epic both teams played hard presser from back in the day. You'll remember.
Both teams play hard. Both teams play hard, my man. Both teams play hard. Both teams play hard. God bless and good night.
See, except with Rasheed, that was fun. Rasheed's answer was fun. This, on the other hand, boring and stupid. Look, I get that you don't want to talk about cutting Rodney Whitehead, but when you cut a guy for being arrested and it turns out to be a mistake, you pretty much have to talk about it. And I know that he wanted to keep repeating that the team made the decision, but if they made the decision with the wrong information, well, what do you do then? Repeating the same answer isn't good enough then. Not only is it not good enough, but it's lame. It's embarrassing. It's insulting. And then, when he was done, Jerry Jones also took a moment for the media, and that was even more bizarre than Garrett.
If y'all have done one thing in my time, and to criticize me is how I will back up a player to a fault. You've done it. You've done it for years for that. I will back them up to a fault. So that when we do make a decision around here that in best interest of the team to move on, there's one thing you can forget about, and that is whether you're being fair or whether you've given it consideration of what it means to the individual. That doesn't happen around here. Thank you, guys.
Huh? The hell are you talking about? Look, I know in the past that Jera and the Cowboys have backed guys up, and they're doing it right now with a number of guys on their roster. No names mentioned, rhymes with Bezekiel Belliot. But they didn't back up Whitehead to a fault. They didn't even come close. Instead, they canned him for something that he didn't even do. And then they didn't want to explain it. Listen, I'm not looking to circumcise a mosquito here.
Circumcising the mosquito. You don't have to do that.
But this is not on the media. This is not on the media. The media did not cut Whitehead. The team did. And then they didn't want to own it when they got it wrong. Teams want players to own up to mistakes. But when they make one of their own, they don't want to talk about it. And if the argument was that getting rid of Whitehead really wasn't about this, it was about all the other things, then he should have been released when those other things happened. It can't be the final straw if the final straw never happened. You made a mistake, admit it, own it. Then we'll all move on. Then we'll all move on. We'll all forgive the mistake. As long as you own it, and they still haven't. We are joined by Andrew Hawkins. Listen, your backstory is amazing, but let me start first with the announcement of your retirement. You've been playing football since you were 8 years old. So exactly today, how does it feel to be retired and to hear yourself now introduced as a former NFL wide receiver?
It's a little different. I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, it feels good because this is the first time I'm not going to training camp. So that's one part that I know for the next 60 years I will not miss. So today it feels good. I can imagine when the season comes around, we start in the end.
But at the same time, every August for practically your entire life, you've been in football camp, even if it's not your favorite thing to do. And then every September, you're playing football. What's it going to feel like not to be doing that?
I hope it feels good, man. Honestly, right. I like you said, I haven't had a free August in 20 years. My mom's birthday is late August. I have a brother whose birthday, and I've never seen them on their birthday. So I'm looking to do that. I'm looking to spend time with the family, do a little traveling, vacation. I got a whole extra month of summer. I plan to take advantage.
Andrew Hawkins joining us. All right, so now that you have that time and you've retired, we can tell your story. It's an amazing story. To fully appreciate your career, you have to go back a little bit. Say to Thanksgiving in 2007. You played your final college game for Toledo. You were thinking about taking a chance at pro football. You go to the gym that weekend, and you weigh in at 161. Obviously not an ideal NFL weight. So then you decided that you were going to give it everything you had, but you were not going to tell anybody about that. Why was that?
At the time, man, I felt like people were going to laugh at me. I haven't told my whole entire life that, football wasn't for me. I wasn't big enough. There was no way it was going to happen. I wasn't this. I wasn't that. And so, you got this dream and you want it so bad. I just didn't want any outside distractions. I didn't want other people telling me what I couldn't do to seep into my thinking at all. So I just thought it was better just to keep it to myself and, you know, work from there. And I'm glad I did. It worked out that way.
Clones, give me a second to talk to you about Ferguson. Ferguson helps facilities pros by supplying innovative and reliable products. But what Ferguson really offers are solutions. Ferguson has a dedicated team of facilities experts, and with nationwide coverage, we deliver directly to your facility right when you need them. Plus, Ferguson's broad inventory of maintenance, repair, and operations products, along with plumbing, HVAC, and appliances, sets Ferguson apart from traditional facility suppliers. So learn more about how Ferguson Facility Supply can help your facility at Ferguson.com today. That's Ferguson. Now it's back to our Daily Jungle. Andrew Hawkins joining us. Now at that time, really the fact is nobody was paying that much attention to you. As an example, you didn't even have an agent, but you had a plan. As you wrote in the Players Tribune, that plan was to create a fake email account posing as an assistant coach at Toledo and then to email some agents. Where did the idea come from, and then how did that go for you?
You know, I'm like the kind of person, like, I'm going to exhaust every avenue to get something done. It's just how I am. So I can't remember where the exact idea came from. It was probably, honestly, one of 20 things that I tried. And it's just the one that eventually ended up sticking and kind of helps the story. But, yeah, it was just like, look, I need to have somebody. I can tell everybody till I'm blue in the face how great I am. You know, and everybody does that about themselves. I need a third party working on my behalf, because then somebody may take me a little bit more serious. And it was what I needed to do to get my agent. I'm still with him to this day, so yeah, I don't think he has any complaints.
It's a great story, and plus, you do need somebody to bang on the table for you. Now, at the same time, you knew you could handle your business in the on-field drills at your pro day, but there was that concern when it came to your measurement. Now, you put on a few pounds in training, but getting taller is not as easy. So, again, you had a plan. It stopped, or it involved a stop at Michael's, the craft store. What did you do then?
Yeah, so I went and got some clay. So I got clay, and it was kind of the same color as my flesh. I molded the clay to make it look like the heel of a foot. And then I taped over it on pro day. I'm like walking on my tippy toes, and it looks like I'm just standing flat-footed, and it gave me an extra inch and a half on pro day. And as soon as they measured me, I cut them off to get ready for my 40, but yeah, I mean, it was just anything to kind of neutralize the notion that I wasn't tall enough. Like, you know, it's almost like you have to be this tall to ride this ride. And still, I mean, even with the inch and a half, I measured it at 5'7½", but, you know, that still sounds better than 5'6". You know what I mean?
Dude, that's absolutely incredible. So it worked. You pick up an inch and a half, and then you parlay that into a tryout for the CFL and the Arena League. Both tryouts go well, and both teams said they'd give you a call, but they never did. So at that point, what were you thinking?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough not to think that you're crazy, right? I mean, you have these great workouts, and I'm not so caught up in myself to not be self-aware, not to see another person and say, okay, that player is better than me, or this player, you know, has these attributes that I might not have. But all these workouts, I was the best guy. If I wasn't the best, I was one or two, and that to me being modest. So in my mind, it was like, man, I know I can play. I just can't make somebody else pull the trigger on me. I can't make someone else take a leap of faith on my ability, and that part was so frustrating to me. And you know, that was a time when I was thinking, like, man, maybe this isn't going to work out.
Andrew Hawkins joining us. Andrew, the thing is, I could do this all day long. I mean, there's story after story after story. As an example, you get a call from the Cleveland Browns. You go to their rookie tryout. You kill the tryout, but you weren't signed then either, so you sat out the entire 08 season. Obviously, you're a guy willing to do absolutely anything, keep pushing. At that point, you just think, man, I don't know what else to do. Maybe the dream really is over.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of had exhausted all avenues, or so I thought at that point. And, you know, there comes a time in everybody's story where there has to be, like, a little bit of luck. So, you know, I tried out for the Browns. I did great. The GM called me to his office, the receiver coach, sat me down and said, you're better than five guys we have on the roster right now. Take my cell phone. Don't do anything until we call you. And then the call never comes, dude. So, you know, I went back to school. I was coaching as a receiver coach and working in a factory and working as a caddy to make ends meet. And then I ended up watching TV and seeing an advertisement for a reality show.
Tell me about the reality show. I know where you're going with it, but what was the reality show, and then what happened?
So the reality show was Fourth and Long with Michael Irvin, and the show was basically it took 12 guys off the street, you know, from different backgrounds and different situations, the reason why they didn't go pro, and they gave them a chance to try with the Dallas Cowboys. So I was on the couch with my roommates, and they were like, hey, you should try out for that show, and I'm like, eh, you know, I played it off, and then I went upstairs and
found the number. I called the production company, got an address. I sent 30 copies of an audition tape, overnighted 10, two-day mail 10, and regular mail 10 to make sure they got it. And I ended up getting the call that I made the sale. So this is luck kind of kicking in, that this new avenue that I didn't even anticipate would be there might give me my chance to get to the NFL.
All right, so you're absolutely relentless, man. I mean, you were exhausting every possibility. You don't give up on the dream. And then you get this shot, and you go to the NFL Combine as a coach with Toledo. But your goal at that point was to meet Jerry Jones. And you spent as much time as you possibly could at the Combine, but you never got a chance to meet Jones. What happened next?
Yeah, so, I mean, I was there because, like I said, I was coaching Toledo, and I had a credential. I knew I was going, literally leaving the next day for the tryout for this reality show, the Final 50. I seen Jerry Jones. I didn't say anything to him, and I kicked myself for it. So basically, I like went through these back stairs of Lucas Oil Stadium. I found what suite the Cowboys were in. I stayed with Jerry Jones. I sat in a stairway for like 2 hours waiting for this guy to come out. My brother was with me. He also used to play in the NFL. He called me like, hey, man, I can't wait anymore. Come pick me up. I had the car, the rental. I drove back to his hotel to pick him up, and I remember thinking, like, man, I was going to stay there all day, whatever it took, to kind of just shake this guy's hand and let him know I wanted to try out for the show so I can get my spot. I pull up to the hotel, and I swear to you, as I pull up, Jerry Jones pulls up right beside me, hops out of the car. He was driving. He went to get his bags. I hopped out of the car so quick just to shake his hand and say, hey, I'm Andrew Hawkins. I'm trying out for your show. Listen, man, I'm what you need. I could be the X Factor, you know, anything I could just to shake the man's hand. And, you know, when I got to the tryout, I told Michael Irvin a story, and I think it honestly helped me when trying to get on the show.
Andrew Hawkins joining us. What was Michael Irvin like with you?
You know, he was an incredible mentor, to be honest, man. I think he believed so much in my abilities. I think the thing that worked against me on the show, because I ended up getting the runner-up and not winning, even though I performed the best on the show, was the fact that it was a reality show. You know, and the Cowboys with so much fanfare, they had this reality show. I think it was hard for people to get over the idea of bringing a 5'6" wide receiver reality show to the Dallas Cowboys. And for that reason, I ended up being runner up, but Michael Irvin the entire time was kind of telling me, listen, man, you're an NFL player. You're an NFL player. And I think the amount of votes that I had at the end kind of got trumped by you know, what was most practical to the fans.
Quarterback Quentin Flowers is my guest. Quentin, really nice to have you on the show. How are you today?
I'm doing good. And yourself?
I'm great. Nice to talk to you. So we're about a month away from the season opener. There's a lot of buzz about the team and about you. You've got a new head coach in Charlie Strong. So what's the mood around the team right now, and how excited are you to start this thing?
You know, excited. You know, knowing that this is my last year, last season, you know, you just got to go out and make everything count. So every day I go out, you know, and stress to my players, you know, we have to go out and make every moment and every play counts on offense. And I just try to be a leader to them guys, you know, and still, at the end of the day, have fun.
USF quarterback Quentin Flowers joining us. So what kind of impressions do you have of Coach Strong so far, and what's he been like to work with?
Coach Strong been, you know, a good coach to work with. Right now, we're still getting to know each other. You know, we laugh and joke around with each other. But, you know, the thing that I like with Coach Strong, you know, he's competitive. You know, he go really hard with his defense, and, you know, he want me to score on our defense every time because he feel like, you know, our defense going to be the top, you know. It just, knowing that, going against a coach like that, you know, who will have your back and want you to succeed, it's just a great feeling.
You know, when we're talking about USF as the favorite to win the conference this season, it is worth remembering that back in 2014, the team went 4-8. So what do you remember about that season, and did you always know that you were building something special?
Yeah, that's the reason why I came here. You know, ever since I was growing up, I always wanted to be a difference maker. When I was getting recruited by USF, the last time I remember, their record was 2-8. And people always ask me, you know, why USF? Why are you going there? I could have went to, you know, a lot of big schools and played different positions, but I just wanted to be a different guy. And I felt like USF was a place that, you know, I could put on top and I could put on the map with a lot of guys that were coming in. And, you know, once I became a starter my sophomore year, you know, me and the guys, we just took it from there and, you know, we wanted to be on top.
Let's be clear about that for a minute, because when you were coming out of high school, there were a lot of big-time programs that wanted you as a running back or a receiver or a safety, but you did decide on USF instead, and you just mentioned why. Let me ask you something else, though. You said, quote, "I could have gone to all the big schools and got championship rings, but I was the guy that wanted to be different and start my own legacy," end quote. So where did that notion of legacy come from, and what would you like your legacy to be at USF?
No, I want my legacy to be, I want to be remembered as, one of the great players that came through USF. I always, my coach in high school always told me, start your own legacy. Don't be like everybody else. And, that's something I always took. In high school, I could have went to Miami Northwestern. I could have went to Miami Central and just, play with Dalvin Cook at Central or play with a couple guys on the team that went to Miami Northwestern. But, I went to Miami Jackson, a school that, really didn't do anything a lot of people, didn't really care about. But my junior year, like I said, I wanted to be a difference maker. And my junior year, I took our school to, the semifinal. That's the farthest school ever been in school history. So I always try to, leave my legacy from where I'm coming from and always, try to be a difference maker, not just be another guy.
USF quarterback Quentin Flowers joining us. Once again, he's been named to the Walter Camp, Maxwell, Johnny Unitas, and Davey O'Brien watch list. The fact that you're having the type of career you're having and that you and I are even having this conversation right now is absolutely incredible, given what's taken place in your life. When you were 7 years old, you were sitting on your father's lap outside of your home in Liberty City, and then you went inside, Quentin, and then moments later, you heard a gunshot. Can you share what happened next?
I was, like you said, I was sitting on my dad's lap. I got up to go use the restroom because he was just about to give me and my friend some money to go to the store. The store is right across the street. So I told him, just hold it. I'm going to run to the restroom and I'll come right back. So I got up. I'll say like 30 seconds later, as soon as I get in the living room, I heard a gunshot. I was a kid, I didn't really like pay attention to like gun violence and everything. But once I got in the bathroom, I looked out the window and I just heard everybody screaming, my mom crying and everything. So I went back out and I just seen my dad, laying on the floor. And from there, I just was hurt from there.
Quentin, you were just 7, and then you mentioned your mom just now. When you were in high school, your mother, Nancy, then passed away after battling cancer. So what was your mother like as a person, and then what kind of an impact did she have on you?
My mom had a huge impact on me. I was the baby. I was the youngest out of 4. She just wanted the best for me. She wanted the best for me and my brothers. And, she always told me. I'll never forget one time I was like 3 blocks away from home, and she called my phone. And she was like, she called me Booby, and she was like, "Hurry up, come. I got to tell you something." And, I'm rushing to get home. I ain't trying to hear what nobody talking about. I'm just trying to get to my mom. And she was like, "Pass me the remote." And that was a funny day that I could remember. But my mom, she was the type of lady that just liked to have fun, trying to get to know everybody, like to have like parties and do fun things with my friends and I. But she was the type of a lady that cared about everybody, not just herself, not just her kids, but the people who around her kids and her too.
Quentin Flowers joining us, USF quarterback. And one of your teammates, Dietrich Nichols, who has known you since you were 7, said, and I quote, "I know what his mom meant to him, and that was heartbreaking, his mom passing away. That was another chance for him to give up, but he kept pushing, and I respect him for that." Quentin, losing a parent is unbelievably painful, but losing both is more than most people could ever handle. How were you able to keep pushing and to stay on?
Like I told you, I had to grow up faster than all the other kids. I had to make a lot of decisions on my own. I really didn't have no parents to, talk to me, or I didn't have that opportunity, to have my mom or my dad to pick the school for me just to show them that I appreciate them. But I had to grow up faster than a lot of other kids. And I just wanted to you know, I didn't want to stop doing what my mom seen me doing. It was a time where, you know, I was hurt. I felt like just giving up on football. I felt like, you know, I didn't want to do it anymore because I lost the main two people in my life at that point. And, you know, it's just like one day I was sleeping. She came back to talk to me and was like, you know, don't give up. Always chase your dream. So that's why, you know, I just kept going every day. Every day I wake up, you know, I just feel like I have to feed someone in my family. You know, I have to do something to be successful in life and, you know, just to make my mom happy, even though she's not here.
Paulie Malignaggi is my guest. Paulie, it's good to have you back. How are you? What's up?
Jim, I'm good. I'm doing good, man. I'm doing good. Just getting ready to watch this game. How are you doing?
Paulie, I'm doing great. Thanks for mixing this one in during the game. I appreciate it. Listen, Paulie, let me start right here. As somebody who's been around boxing his entire life, what did you think, Paulie, when you first heard the idea that Conor McGregor, coming from MMA, was going to fight Floyd Mayweather in a boxing match? Did you think it was serious at first, or did you think that was just a whole lot of talk early on?
Yeah, I got to admit, Jim, I thought it was a lot of talk at first. You know, I didn't really take it too seriously. You know, I thought, you know, this guy's a big self-promoter, and he's probably just using the Mayweather name to continue to promote himself big time because, you know, he's obviously a big self-promoter, and he's a big-time name in mixed martial arts in general. So I didn't think he was actually going to cross over, but I thought he was going to use the talk to kind of hype himself up in the mixed martial arts world.
All right, then when he got that boxing license, Paulie, you were critical of his chances and, in fact, threatened to knock the beard off his face. Initially, did you think that he was being disrespectful to the sport of boxing?
I just thought he was taking it a little too lightly. So at first I was like, you know what, if anybody's going to jump on this opportunity to fight this guy because he brings a lot of money, I said, you know what, let me be the first one to jump on it. You know, I've got a pretty big name in boxing and maybe I can get him to fight, you know. So I started trying to bait him a little bit and just to kind of gauge how serious he was, you know. And obviously it didn't work. He obviously went for the biggest fish you can get, Floyd Mayweather, and he managed to get him out of retirement and get Floyd. So, you know, I ended up taking a backseat, obviously, as you can see.
Hey, Paulie, I see it working. You had to try. All right, then last week, you sparred with Conor. First off, how did the meeting come about? And then what do you make of the fact that he wanted to work with somebody who had been critical of him?
You know, the sparring came about because I have a friend who's Irish, who I used to train with in Los Angeles back when I was training in Los Angeles. His name is Dean Byrne. And Dean's brother is Jerry Byrne, and Jerry is on the Conor McGregor team. You know, he's on the Conor McGregor training team. Dean called me up and he said, you know, can I get my brother to talk to you? He wants to talk to you about working with Conor. So I said, hey, man, no problem, but I'm retired. I'm not sure what they want, you know? So, you know, make a long story short, Jerry called me and we made an agreement and we kind of came out. You know, now how do I feel about Conor working with me despite me having been critical of him? I think it shows his willingness to learn. I think it shows his willingness to, you know, put pride aside and get to work. But we went at it pretty good on Thursday, so I think you know, he wanted to show me that maybe you know, he should be taken a little bit more seriously than I was taking him. You know,
Paulie Malignaggi joining us. He's at Yankee Stadium of all places. Now, Paulie, the initial plan was to go 6 rounds, but you guys end up going 8 rounds. How would you describe it, and then what do you make of what you saw from him?
You know, it's hard to get into ins and outs because I don't want to bust his game plan. But I'll tell you what, Conor is a tough guy. He's trying his best to win the fight, and he's trying to put a particular game plan together that is a bit awkward. You know, I don't think Conor can learn to box fundamentally sound in just a few months. So he was always going to be a bit awkward. I think anybody coming from MMA to boxing would always be a bit on the awkward side. But making it work, the way I describe this is he knows what he wants to do, and he has a method to the mayhem. He has a method to how he wants to do it. Now, the work was good. The work was rough. The work was good. We did 8 hard rounds. We were supposed to do 6, so we ended up going 8. I think some of it had to do with some of the bad blood that maybe he might have had from talking to Charlton Price, but I did. But we did go pretty good. And, you know, he showed me that, hey, he's at least serious about this. I can't say, based on a sparring session, oh, I'm going to pick this guy to win the fight. But I will say this. He's serious about what he wants to do. He has an awkwardness to where he can land some shots. And he's got, you know, I wouldn't say his power is what the reputation holds it for. I wouldn't say it's that strong. But his power is enough to where you definitely should respect it.
You know, Paulie, to that point, he's got a heavy, heavy left hand for MMA, but how does that punching power compare to a boxer's punching power?
It's definitely above average. You know, I wouldn't say it's oh my God power. That's what I kind of been talking about. You know, there's what I call oh my God power when somebody hits you, even in sparring, and you're like, oh my God, you know, like, wow, this guy really hits hard. You know, I've been in with guys, even in the past year, I sparred a guy named Amir Imam, who's a 140-pound contender, and, you know, in Miami. And I remember thinking, wow, this guy's got all my God power. Like, you know, and he's a 140-pound contender in boxing, you know. Yeah, oh my God power is very rare, Jim. You know, there's above average power and then there's oh my God power. You know, I say Conor has above average power. So if he lands a good shot on you and he's landing with a small fight glove, he will hurt you. But it's not oh my God power where every time he's touching you, you're like, my goodness, this is very uncomfortable. You know, it's not that kind of power, but it's good enough.
Paulie Malignaggi joining us. Paulie, what about Floyd? I'm not saying that he needs that to win this fight, of course, but at age 40, a couple of years from his last fight, does he have oh my God power?
Floyd? No, I would not. I don't think Floyd ever had oh my God power, right. Actually. You know, I think Floyd managed to win fights based on his intelligence, his reflexes, his variation to his boxing style. I think oh my God power is very rare. Even among the world class fraternity of fighters, oh my God power is very rare. You know, but just because you have oh my God power doesn't mean you're going to become a world champion. Just because you don't doesn't mean you're not going to become a world champion. I think there's a lot of pieces to the puzzle to become a world class fighter, to become a championship level fighter. So Conor having the above average power, for me, is totally fine. It is respectable. And believe me, if he hits a guy with lighter gloves, despite a smaller fight gloves, he will hurt.
Hey, Paul, let me ask you this. I mean, you're not going to give up the game plan, but we know he's got that left hand, but he's obviously going to have more than that to have any kind of shot to even do any damage, much less win the fight. Does Conor have another weapon or two that he can turn to?
You know, that's one of the things I can't get into, Jim. He's got a style he's devising that is looking to, you know, be effective on different degrees and on different levels. And I think you have to be effective on different levels and different degrees, because you're fighting a guy like Floyd Mayweather who can make adjustments. So, you know, there are other avenues of being successful that Conor is implementing and he's doing in his training. And, of course, we'll continue to try to perfect them as training goes along. I'll continue to spar with him, and we'll see how he comes along.
All right, before I let you go really quickly, we already know, or we have an idea what Conor's mindset is. What do you think Floyd's thinking? I mean, is he looking to knock him out, or is he looking to just pick him apart for 12 rounds?
I think Floyd will respect you as much as he's forced to respect you. I think if Floyd sees that you have nothing there, I think Floyd will go for the stoppage. You know, I think if Floyd sees, okay, I can beat this guy, but I've got to be careful, I think Floyd will be comfortable going for the decision victory. You know, and then you also can put a wild card in there. You also have to see what Floyd bets on himself, you know, or how he bets on himself. He bets on himself going the distance. If he bets on himself going the knockout, because let's face it, Floyd loves to play the Vegas casinos.
That's a pretty good tell right there. Last question. Do you think that Conor truly believes, Paulie, that he can win this fight, or is he thinking, man, this is a great money-making situation, and whatever happens, happens?
Well, I think first and foremost, the great money-making situation, so that's always on your mind. Now, is he going through the steps to try to win the fight? I believe he is. I mean, listen, he's working hard every single day. He's putting in the maximum work he can do. He's willing to make himself uncomfortable to a degree. A piece of me thinks, you know, that he does want to win the fight. Then a piece of me starts to think, oh, you know, a lot of it is also big promotion. He brought me in for a big promotion last week. It got a lot of media headlines. We boxed Thursday. We were supposed to box Saturday, but we did not box Saturday. And I was wondering why we did not box Saturday. You know, so I started wondering, maybe I got brought in just for the headlines, and maybe he doesn't want to work as hard as it's been all the time with me. Or maybe he's just, you know, conceding me for when I get back next week. So we'll see. You know, I want to believe in my mind that Conor believes he's going to win the fight. I believe what he's been talking, in the way, for the most part, the way I've seen him behaving in the gym shows me he believes he's going to win the fight. But ultimately, it will be up to him, and we'll see how he closes camp.
Paulie, actually, I lied. I got one more follow, because I've seen other boxers talking about this. I mean, do you think it's a one-off? Do you think that he fights this fight and he's done in boxing? Or is there some kind of small chance that maybe he would box again?
If I box again, you know, I was thinking the same thing. You know, you can make more money in boxing. We have the Ali Act you're protected by that, at least, you know, it's not going to prevent you from being screwed 100%, but it prevents you from being screwed the way they screw fighters in mixed martial arts. So I think, you know, there's a possibility that Conor may box again, realizing he can make more money this way, and realizing he can keep a bigger chunk and percentage of the money that he brings in, as opposed to having to share most of it with everybody else. I don't think it's a far-fetched conclusion that he boxed again. But I think for now, the focus should be on one person and one fight, and that should be the Mayweather fight.
Let's go to Buffalo. Rick in Buffalo has a golden ticket. Let's find out in a couple of minutes whether he still has it. Rick, what's going on? Nice to have you.
It's Smack Off Week, Jim. How could things be any better? Two reasons for my call today. First, I got more top shelf material than I could ever fit into one Smack Off call, and I don't like anything going to waste. And second, I got an abundance of what Dan in Denver lacks: balls. Like every year, Jim, Lots of great storylines heading into Friday. What's Left going to do for an encore? Can Mike finally win one solo? Is Chael going to make his call mid-roid rage? But the most entertaining one that seems to be getting a little traction lately is the notion that Mark and Boston can somehow win this thing. Nothing like a little false hope. I'm no man, but being a Michigan football man, you're used to that this time of year. And we're all dying to know, Mark. How's the book you've been working on the last 10 years coming along? If your witty tweets are any indication of your writing ability, we're all in for a real treat. Chapter 1, my unrequited love affair with Jim Harbaugh. Chapter 2, I'm a bigger Detroit Lions fan than you'll ever be. Conclusion, my unrequited love affair with Jim Harbaugh. And don't leave us hanging, Nomad. Are you going to include the bonus chapter where you complain about your job and share pictures of your kids? Or is that reserved exclusively for social media? I know, Mark, you're just giving your people what they want. And let me tell you, you're absolutely killing it with the all-important menopausal female demographic. Looking forward to your ninth place call, brother. And one more thing, Jim. I got to give Kyrie Irving a ton of credit for making it crystal clear he's not going to be held hostage by the NBA's all-time leading narcissist, LeBron James. Too bad the city of Cleveland isn't that smart. But as Draymond Green so perfectly put it, they aren't the sharpest people around. Instead, these idiots are going to keep falling at the feet of their Lord and Savior, King James. And you know what he's going to do? Leave again anyways. A little advice for you, Cavs fans. Instead of torching your jerseys this time around, just stash them in the bottom drawer so they'll be all ready to go when he comes back in 4 years saying, all I ever wanted to do was retire a Cavalier because you sheep are going to eat it up. Nobody more pathetic than you, Cleveland. That's it for now, Jim. As the old saying goes, you can't win the smack off on Wednesday. Well, you sure as hell can improve your chances of getting it.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Alvin, there's just one last thing, one thing left for you to do. You had a ticket and now you don't, Rick. You had a ticket and now you don't. Rick, this is Beachfront Real Estate. Tyler in Edmonton. Tyler, what's going on?
What's going on, man? How's it going?
Up? Good, good, bud. How about you?
I'm good. Well, you challenged the ticket holders yet again, and I, like the rest of the clones, am thoroughly disappointed at the lack of stones from the rest of these rooks. Except when your first and only respectable ticket holder shows up to pick up the pieces time and time again. Also, isn't it kind of ironic for all the defenseless Canadian blasts I've heard over the years that we have a bunch of Americans hiding out in their bunkers hoarding their D-class material, and there is one lone Canadian fighting the choppa. Except now we have this group of pansies throwing out the old, decrepit, screaming Rick in Buffalo to fight their fight for them. And look how that went. I got news for all you Boy Scouts. You got to put work in at practice if you want to get on the power play come game time. Now, quickly, a couple guys who are not worth mentioning on Friday. Caleb in Green Bay. Since when is making fun of yourself considered smack talk? Everyone knows you're a fat creep, all right? We get it. That joke has been beaten to death. I wasn't totally sold that you were into pedophilia, but you started tipping the scale on that one. Not sure how a guy gets any respect for making fun of himself for living with his mom when mentioning someone else living at their mom's is a bad take in itself. Keep hitting singles, Caleb. Mark in Hollywood, I know you're a high-pitched bitch that probably enjoys listening to Bieber while you and Lee Jenkins brush each other's hair. You've relied on more stunts than that kiss-ass left in Laguna. Talk about your insecurities is also a pathetic attempt at getting pity votes. What was that anyway? That part where you and Lee finished each other's lines like a terrible reset of an old Disney movie that you never made? I was actually embarrassed for both of you two that two grown men would come up with something that childish in a smack-off call. Man the hell up, Mark. Unwar spineless golden ticket holders. War Canada. I'm done.
Rock him. No way we're taking his. No way we're going to rip his. Tyler and Edmonton not only made that call, not only made a really good call on Wednesday, unlike Rick. If I'm not mistaken, that's the third call he's made since getting that golden ticket. That guy's not afraid. He's not afraid, and as you notice, he's getting stronger. He's getting better. He's in the gym. Working the muscle. He's got... See, that That only enhanced his chances of getting on Friday. So one guy lost his, one guy kept his. Let's find out if a third guy gets his. Cal in Vegas, the call that he's making to get a golden ticket. Hey, Cal, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I came for Rick's golden ticket. Hey, Jim, the other day, Left in Laguna DM'd me, give me advice on how to win another golden ticket. Left, I don't need your help. I need your help about as much as Alvin needs to support another kid. Jim, I know I'm a lightning rod. That's because I'm the smack-off version of Donald Trump. It's not just because I'm rich. It's because I'm polarizing. Hack won't hate me. I have haters because I'm good-looking. I drive sports cars. And my girlfriend is way hotter than theirs. Jim, it's not my fault that half of your audience is a bunch of mentally challenged liberals. I mean, the other half of your audience loves me. Like that clone that has two cats, one named Cal, the other one Vegas. Jim, this year's smack-off is going to be a lot different. Les is not going to win this year. It's because I know what he's going to do. He's going to do the same thing that he's done the past 2 years, stalk you. I'll fill you in on a little secret. Randall helps Les with the smack-off calls, and Randall is only good at one thing, stalking. Yeah! The only difference is this year Les is going to raise your house on a surfboard. Van Smack, you better hurry up and get a restraining order. Les, that garbage ain't going to work this year. You're played out. Straight Smack is going to win this year, which pretty much makes me the odds-on favorite. Les, since you're the Jungle's resident prop comic, I have a prop for you. This is what I think of your Jungle calls. Listen closely. Clones, I'll see you on Friday. Get your popcorn ready.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Bro, was that on-air flatulence? Is that your idea, Smack? Is that what you were going to do? Quote, fart your way into the smack-off? Cal, we're not going to see you on Friday. This guy goes way, way back. Way, way back with the program. Used to call the show, was a good enough caller that he parlayed that into a position on the XR4TI, then went out and did his own thing, but still pays it back, still comes in and participates in the smack-off. We go now to D.C. Dan in D.C. I've got to think that he's calling with an RSVP. My man Dan, what's going on? How are you?
I'm great, Romy. What is up?
What's up, Dan? Good to hear your voice.
Yeah, it's great to be back in the jungle, and I do. I graciously accept your invitation to the 23rd Smack-Off. I'm excited. I like what you said about Conor McGregor's chances against Floyd, and that's how I'm heading into this Smack-Off on Friday. There's very little pressure on me, and who knows, I may just land that left hook. Or I could be like that Chinese golfer, Li Haotang at the British, who shot 63 on Sunday to almost rip that Cleric Judd from Jordan Spieth. I don't know, Rome. I guess we'll find out if obscure Asian golf references are the makings of a great smack-off call. Then look out, clones. And, Romy, you know, like you said, if I do win and I win this thing and you want me to make another excursion out to Cali to be part of your team again, just know that I have responsibilities back here in D.C. I have a house. I have a job. I have a wife. I have kids. I have bills. I have a wife. I can't just gallop off to Cali and leave it all behind. Or can I? I'll see how it goes Friday. Follow me on Twitter, clones, at Dan from D.C. Romy, keep up the good work. Out.
All right, we'll see what he does. Listen, once again, he's got the game. He's got the game to be in. He had enough game to be a part of the XR4TI. He obviously was not going to show you too much of that playbook. It's kind of vanilla, right? Preseason, you're not going to run what you do. You're going to save what you have. For the regular season, I think that's what he was doing right there. But it's an RSVP. Dan in D.C. Or was he looking for a job? Or both? We'll find out. Friday. That's it for now. Once again, one more show until the smack-off. Make sure you subscribe to the Daily Jungle to keep it locked. Catch you right back here tomorrow. We are out.
Hey, Jerome, how are you?
What do you say, King of the Jungle?
What do you say, man? How you feeling?
You know, the cat that just called 2 calls ago from Cleveland. I could paraphrase, you know, Jim Mora. Cleveland? 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 Come on. When you have pro teams and you have pro championships, you have pro athletes, you can talk the smack. But you're from Cleveland, okay? Boston is now the city of champions. Get used to it. Deal with it. Okay? And until you step up and bring home some hardware, you earn the right to talk the smack. Not just because you're from Cleveland. Okay? Bohica, buddy. That stands for bend over here. It comes again. I'm out, Rome.